The main difference between psychedelics and pharmaceuticals is really quite simple. Pharmaceuticals are intended to treat something at its surface in the form of temporary symptom management, while psychedelics focus on the deeper core of the issue and aim to permanently remove the root cause. The use of psychedelics for healing is nothing new. Humans have been using visionary plants and fungus as medicine for thousands of years. We see examples of this in every corner of the globe, from ancient Egypt to the Aztecs to Greek antiquity. It is even a growing theory that Homo sapiens developed bigger brains and a higher level of consciousness because they consumed psilocybin mushrooms over hundreds of generations. Although much of these plant medicine rituals have been replaced by Western medicine, psychedelics are revealing that they can be incredibly effective at solving our health issues of today. For example, psilocybe cubensis, also known as magic mushrooms, have been proven to be powerful agents for curing depression, anxiety, and addiction when used purposefully with the intention of healing. Since the 1960s, psilocybin has been widely regarded as a party drug, used by young people at music festivals and hippie drum circles. It is this stigma that has caused mushrooms and most other psychedelics to be categorized as a highly illegal Schedule I drug, the possession of which is a felony under federal law and can land you 20 years in prison. So for the last 60 years, the medicinal benefits of mushrooms were disregarded, and in place came the rise of massive pharmaceutical companies that profited off a perpetually sick population. But things are changing, and thankfully science is opening the door to psychedelic research and new possibilities. After decades of stigma and resistance, the gap between spirit and science is closing. But before we label psychedelics as the be-all and end-all cures to mental health disorders, we must first understand why they work. What researchers are finding is that psychedelics present an opportunity for the patient to self-heal, by freeing them from the limitations of their perspectives of reality and allow wisdom and understanding to penetrate their consciousness. With new awareness, their perspective shifts and they come to view the source of their depression and problems in a new way. Going to the core of what was causing the problem, bringing healing and forgiveness to that place and liberating them from that problem. Sadly, as many of us know, our healthcare system is an industry just like every other. A patient cured is a customer lost. And this brings us back to the original point. Psychedelics are so effective at treating mental health issues that they are bad for business. A single mushroom experience can change someone's life forever, which is great for the patient, but does nothing to make money for the pharmaceutical companies. No matter what obstacles stand in our way, it's important that we explore alternate states of consciousness. There is a vast realm of love and understanding beyond this third-dimensional reality. If we want to know how to fix the world, we must first understand how to fix ourselves. Einstein said, "No problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it." The remainder of today's episode is from the original Gaia series, Psychedelica. This presentation will dive deep into the sphere of psilocybin mushrooms. How can we use them safely and responsibly? What message are they trying to send us? Could they be the solution our species is searching for? Sit back and enjoy this enlightening presentation.
The story of psilocybin, or commonly known as magic mushrooms, is a long and controversial one. Because of Hollywood, Disney films, and word of mouth, psychedelic mushrooms have been given a serious reputation. Are they drugs? Are they medicine? Are they safe? Are they keys to heaven or hell? Let's put the rumors aside and investigate what we know to date. It has been suggested that because psilocybin mushrooms most commonly grew in droppings of cattle, and these animals have been revered and followed by many humans and religions for thousands of years, it is unlikely that our ancestors disregarded these mushrooms and ignored experiencing their mind-bending effects. What exactly is the mysterious world of the magic mushroom experience? What is the latest scientific research showing us? What are the most cutting-edge and cultural uses of them? And what might they be trying to teach us? These strange beings have been speculated to predate the human race. They may be able to survive intergalactic space travel and even volatile entry into Earth's atmosphere. Floating from unknown distances to our planet, our species, and into our minds. Mushroom species outnumber plant species 10 to 1, and their mycelia spreads far and wide under the Earth to connect with, communicate to, and integrate a fractal web across many life forms. Terence McKenna wrote from the perspective of the mushroom in the book Psilocybin, Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide. I am old, older than thought in your species, which is itself 50 times older than your history. Though I have been on Earth for ages, I am from the stars. My home is no one planet, for many worlds scattered through the shining disk of the galaxy have conditions which allow my spores an opportunity for life. His brother, ethnobotanist Dennis McKenna, traces this mysterious spore's historical use.
The mushrooms were used in Mexico, the psilocybin mushrooms, by the Aztecs, the Mayas, and probably the Mazatecs and even older cultures. So that's the epicenter of the use of these Psilocybe cubensis, which grows on cow dung and is a globally distributed mushroom. They'll show up pretty much in any pasture in the tropics where you have cattle. So they had to be around for millions of years, you know, or many hundreds of thousands of years, probably in proximity to human civilizations or nomadic tribes if they had cattle. But then we also know there's evidence they were used in Europe and probably in South America, maybe in Africa, maybe in Asia. So how long have they been used? There's no way to know. But I would like to think they've been used a very long time.
Because most of the classical psychedelics require human intervention, psilocybin mushrooms were probably the first psychedelic to be discovered, as they grew anywhere in the tropics or subtropical climates and would appear sprouting from the droppings of large animals like cows. They could stand as much as a foot tall with a cap the size of a dinner plate. It's likely that the first wave of experiences with eating these mushrooms would have made the individual think that they had been poisoned. But after a while, the phenomena would likely have been seen as divine, otherworldly, and quite possibly an experience with death and rebirth, a resurrection of the psyche. When the Spanish conquistadors spread through present-day Mexico, exploring new lands, they encountered many indigenous groups practicing peculiar rituals. The 16th century Aztec statue of Xochipilli was found in southern Mexico with engravings of sacred psychoactive plants like tobacco, morning glory along with several other flowers, and the psilocybe aztecorum mushrooms. Maya archaeologist Stefan de Borhegi believed that hallucinogenic mushroom rituals were central to Maya religions. The mushroom stones of the Guatemalan highlands date to at least 1000 BC and are believed to have been used to honor and grind the dried mushrooms before use. There are some that believe that these mushrooms, or the ergot fungus that grew on barley, were used in the Eleusinian Mysteries fabled Kaikeion brew.
The question is, you know, what were they offering to these people that they kept the attention of the antique world for 2,000 years? It's a long time. I mean, fads come and go, but what they were doing was not quite clear until Albert Hofmann, discoverer of LSD, Gordon Wasson, who brought the Mexican magic mushrooms from the Mazatec culture, and Karl Rapp, Greek scholar. They spent several years, very, very meticulous research, and they came to the conclusion that the key was a beverage, sacred beverage, which was called Kikeon, K-Y-K-E-O-N, that was administered in a very critical part of the ceremony.
These mysterious events spanned from 1600 BC to 392 AD, until Theodosius I closed the sanctuaries. The exact recipe has never been found, and the last remaining hints of the mystery school was demolished by King Alaric of the Goths, who brought a Christian invasion to destroy the old sites. This invasion was the beginning of a long reign of the new religion in town, forbidding the use of plant sacraments. Now fast forward to 1955. R. Gordon Wasson, who is an amateur mycologist and banker to J.P. Morgan, made his way to Sierra Mazateca in southern Mexico to visit a curandera named Maria Sabina. In this shamanic village, Sabina was known for healing her community with powerful mushroom rituals. She agreed to welcome Wasson into one of the rituals in good faith that he could take pictures, but none were allowed to be published. This was to maintain the sacred space of those being healed and to protect the village from outsiders knowing too much of their rituals. So Wasson agreed and proceeded to take private pictures of Maria Sabina, calling in the mushroom spirits for healing.
She said the spirits in the mushrooms, the ninos, the little children, are the ones that she worked with in concert with the mushroom entities for healing for her patients. So Gordon Wasson went down and had a photographer and had a team of people and published this in 1957. It hit in Life magazine in 1957 and then got into every, you know, home in Middle America, and basically initiated the psychedelic 60s in 57 by telling people that this mushroom existed in Mexico, which altered consciousness and had this shamanic lineage.
On May 13th, 1957, Life magazine published Wasson's photographs, and the story of the mushroom rituals swept through the Western world. Flocks of Americans began to flood this small town in search of the most mind-expanding experience they could find. Sabina was reported as saying, "It doesn't work in this way. The spirits of the mushrooms help to heal humanity from illness instead of introducing them to God." But by this point, the Western world was hypnotized by the claims being made about these mushrooms, and shortly thereafter, the university studies began, but not without pushback.
There is nothing smart, there is nothing grown up or sophisticated in taking an LSD trip at all. They're just being complete fools.
Now, don't you feel that it's wrong to encourage the use of these illegal drugs by college students? This is, in effect, isn't it, encouraging the breaking of a law?
Well, I never tell anyone what to do with their body, because what we're talking about here is the first and last frontier freedom, my body.
Timothy Leary was a part of the original psilocybin studies at Harvard University. 40 years after these studies and after the prohibition of psychedelics finally loosened, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Roland Griffiths, took up psilocybin research once more.
We began our studies in 2000, and I initiated my interest in this because I had taken a meditation practice up and I was interested in shifts in states of consciousness. I was actually skeptical about the idea that psilocybin could produce deeply spiritually significant mystical type experiences, but indeed the data spoke very clearly to us that it could. So we did choose psilocybin, I think, thoughtfully. One is that most people at the time we initiated this work couldn't spell psilocybin, didn't quite know what it was, and it certainly didn't have the cultural baggage that LSD did. So LSD and mescaline have very long duration of action, more in the order of 12 hours, as opposed to psilocybin, which is, you know, 4 to 6 hours. So that makes it a much more tractable compound to work with in a clinical setting. DMT, on the other hand, is very short-acting and can also be given with a MAO inhibitor.
An MAO inhibitor makes DMT last 4 to 6 hours, but but the pharmacology is more complex and difficult to receive approval from the FDA. However, psilocybin produces similar results with far less complexity.
The psilocybin molecule and the DMT molecule are very closely related to one another. In a sense, psilocybin can be rightly described as orally active DMT, because DMT is not normally orally active.
Even though the molecules are very similar, the mind-expanding experiences aren't as similar as it would seem. Each psychedelic molecule, called the tryptamine, is structured in a very specific way to trigger specific neurotransmitters in the brain, causing every psychedelic plant to elicit different effects, and it all depends upon the neurotransmitters that the substances play on. Serotonin mimicking is the hallmark of psychedelica. Serotonin allows human consciousness to assemble the consensus reality that we typically inhabit, and it even affords us our sense of self and identity. And psilocybin mushrooms break down the rigid perceptions of normal waking consciousness.
Psilocybin appears acutely to decrease activity within a certain network of brain hubs called the default mode network. And that network is very active under conditions of vigilance and depression. And it's deactivated when people are, for instance, long-term meditators. And it's thought that that area is somehow tied up in with respect to self-referential processing, a sense of self. It turns out that psilocybin decreases default mode networking or functioning much as the same way that meditation decreases activity in that brain center. And that brain center happens to be activated in depression, so that might account for antidepressant effects of psilocybin.
The fact that brain imaging is now showing similar results between the benefits of psilocybin and meditation has not only confirmed what Tim Leary, Richard Alpert, and Ralph Metzner were looking for in the original Harvard studies, it seems to lend to the healing properties of ancient shamanic tribes as well. For the experiences met within the psilocybin trip are seen by spiritual adepts to be mere glimpses into the higher domains. They are not necessary to get us there, and if done irresponsibly, they will atrophy our inner faculties that allow us to achieve these states without these substances. So the judicious use of psychedelics are seen by many to be merely the reminder that these states exist, that inner healing is possible, that human consciousness is not static, but an ever-evolving phenomena. Therefore, long-term meditators and psilocybin volunteers at Johns Hopkins are tapping into their own neurology and disrupting the inner identity that is unwell. What does it mean that destabilizing people's sense of self can be useful in healing? Is it because human illness lies in our beliefs about ourselves and how we fit into the world around us? Why are the same effects seen in long-term meditators?
They're fundamentally reorganizational experiences that people describe as having a sense of interconnectedness of all people and things, a sense of sacredness, a truth value, an authenticity to the experience that they find uniquely compelling and authoritative, positive mood, a sense of love or open-heartedness, transcendence of time and space, and then another feature described as ineffability. They find it difficult to put these experiences in words.
Whether it's caused by a psychedelic substance, the act of meditation, or caused spontaneously, recalling mystical-type experiences in words seems to pale in comparison to the underlying meaning. However, whether the experience itself can be spoken about or not, psilocybin mushrooms are being found to help with a number of epidemic-level health issues in the modern world.
The spectrum of therapeutic effects are great, you know. Anxiety in terminal patients, anxiety about, you know, existential anxiety for people who are dying, that's one. PTSD, it's promising for that. It looks promising for addictions. There's been spectacular work on psilocybin and smoking cessation, which is kind of unexpected, but it's very effective for smoking cessation. Depression is another one. Depression is being identified as these FDA protocols are advanced and psilocybin can have a therapeutic effect on it.
While so many mental and physical health issues are given hope in the face of new psilocybin research, the fact that federally controlled research is being overseen by someone who is open to studying and mapping even the abstract phenomenon that fill people with purpose and meaning is hopeful to those who believe that there is more than meets the eye behind these psychedelic journeys that people are explaining.
I think that the most compelling and remarkable finding across all of our populations is that psilocybin, when administered under these conditions to people who have been carefully screened and prepared, and then receive psilocybin in a setting such as this, when they're laying on a couch and have eye shades on and headphones, and they're in the presence of people who have developed rapport and trust with them, that the great majority of these people have these remarkable experiences that, in fact, map on to naturally occurring mystical type experiences.
When the mindset and physical setting has been carefully constructed for a healing experience, there is an abundance of accounts of not only the occurrence of healing, but a congruent sense of a deep inner knowing that the healing is beyond physical mechanisms alone, that an underlying universal shift is taking place, and the whole being, not just the body, is receiving healing. That we are more than what we could ever conceive of, and in fact, we are all different expressions of the same underlying fabric. And because these mushrooms reliably bring about these experiences, the neurology can finally be analyzed in a scientific setting.
We know that people have such experiences in absence of psychedelics, but under these special set and setting conditions, we can occasion these experiences at very high probability. And that opens this up to the interrogation by scientific method. So we can now ask questions about the nature of these experiences and the transformative changes that heretofore couldn't be asked because we didn't understand what processes or what conditions optimize the probability of these experiences.
Because scientific technology has advanced considerably since the 1960 Harvard studies, psilocybin effects on the brain are far more understood today. With the destabilization of the default mode network in the brain causing for interneural communication to change dramatically, we have a glimpse at what functions of the brain hold trauma in the body. Most physiological illness that has been conditioned into us is seen as unhealthy communication between brain regions. When someone has the opportunity to view their life, their beliefs, their world, and the interactions between them all in a new and unbiased perspective, as psychedelics often do, it seems that the innate intelligence of the human being can identify the communication error and bring neurochemical processes back into balance, whereas most pharmaceutical meds address symptoms only and most of the time merely mask them. Psilocybin is being seen to address the source of these symptoms, causing a lasting rippling effect into all areas of life.
I think the most interesting feature is not that these drugs produce these acute salient effects, but that these effects are remembered and they're become attribution points for which people say, you know, I remember that experience every day. My life has changed because of it. My attitudes have changed because of it. We really only at this point have the faintest hint of what kind of network processes, what kind of brain processes are altered, exactly which networks are involved and how they interact is still largely a mystery to us.
Perhaps science is still unable to definitively map the neurological basis of psilocybin, but new advancements are seen in our understanding of these mushrooms' effects on the brain. Meanwhile, To arrive at the mind-bending and life-changing experiences that they afford, people have been left to secretive methods to get their hands on them, keeping this age-old sacrament and its shamanic use alive in the underground.
Mushrooms are recolonizing the world right now, like one basement at a time. A lot of people are growing this medicine and are using it with sacred intention and not speaking about it very much. It's a very personal experience for them. And people are cultivating mushrooms both for large experiences, big spiritual, transpersonal experiences, but people are also primarily cultivating this medicine for microdosing and using incredibly low doses of psilocybin mushrooms pretty regularly for the treatment of depression, anxiety, or to provide a little more energy than they would normally have.
Microdosing psychedelic plants has been popularized mostly by Dr. James Fadiman, who after 40 years of experience has called this sub-perceptible dose a problem-solving amount, whereas moderate doses are effective for therapy and high doses for spirituality. And because of this, the phenomena has recently found itself in unsuspecting places like the workplace in Silicon Valley and other analytical occupations.
A lot of software engineers, myself included, tend to be victims of constrained thinking, or we think very logically and analytically, like this is the way, like, you know, you start seeing code everywhere and everything you look at. But the psychedelics just take all that and rip it up and tear it into pieces, and you're like, oh my God, I don't really know what I know anymore. And that can be really difficult and really, really amazing. And so like with engineering, what it tends to do is I'll like get stuck on a problem, you know, like maybe it's some engineering solution. I just can't think of anything. And I sit with it. And then I just like suddenly, like I can almost see the problem I'm working on, like in three dimensions, you know what I mean? Like with my eyes closed or whatever, and just see it in a new way.
Dosage is the most surefire way to dramatically change the effects gained from psychedelic mushrooms. Terence McKenna is known for categorizing what he called a heroic dose at 5 or sometimes 5.5 grams. To most, this would be considered an amount enough to elicit a spiritual experience. Psychologist and author Rick Strassman, aside from his famed DMT research, also administered psilocybin to volunteers in a lesser-known study.
The kinds of psilocybin doses, which are now being called high, were just barely threshold psychedelic in our volunteers. So, and our final large dose of psilocybin, if we had continued with the studies, would have been twice what's considered a high dose now. So that's what was the main finding. We just pushed the dose more than anybody had ever pushed it.
The doses in Dr. Strassman's studies were over 8 grams. This is almost twice as much as Terence McKenna's heroic dose.
Now we know that the probability of having salient experiences increases as a function of dose, but the probability of having difficult experiences also increases as a function of dose. But I should say that very often it's those deeply uncomfortable experiences that provide a window of opportunity through which, if people can investigate and go through, they'll open into larger experiences. So very often, experiences that people will subsequently describe as having been difficult are among the most interesting and meaningful to them.
Trauma is typically deeply uncomfortable at the moment of its adoption, as it's an experience that is too intense or complex to process all at once. So the memory is stored in the neurology and the tissues of the body, awaiting a moment to resurface and continue being processed, so it can finally be surrendered and let go of. Perhaps that is why these larger doses are useful. They destabilize the habitual processes of the brain, which likely serve as a distraction and suppressant of trauma and unwanted aspects of the psyche. But once this neural habituation is destabilized, the natural healing intelligence of the human being goes into house cleaning mode, and old wounds are addressed. But what happens beyond these doses? There are accounts from Kalindi Iyi, a martial arts instructor and mycologist, who regularly takes 30-plus grams in one setting, six times the heroic dose. The experience, as he publicly noted, is beyond language, beyond the five senses, and deeply embedded in a world of symbolism and primal forces that obliterate the concepts of space-time. At these astronomical doses, he mentions that the set and setting has less of an impact on the journey to come. Higher doses become less therapeutic and far more mystical. The mystical experience may be deeply transformative, however, it can also be traumatizing to experience such intensity to the untrained or uninitiated, which is counterintuitive to the purpose of the therapeutic doses. In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the feeling of safety is second only to food, water, warmth, and rest. And you can rest assured that most of those needs may not be met with higher doses of psilocybin either. A child entering this world instantly latches on to predictability and sources of safety and sustenance from parents, environment, and culture. Anything less causes anxiety, fear, and eventually trauma. Psilocybin mushrooms, even in moderate doses of 3 to 4 grams, tends to dissolve our grip on these needs. 5 to 8 grams pushes this boundary to the limit of consensus sanity. Some believe that nothing valuable lies beyond that limit. Nothing out there can be brought back here and made sense of. But as we see with psychonauts of DMT, or initiates of the mystery schools like Eleusis, pushing the envelope is the name of the game. Venturing where no one has gone before is born into some seeker's very nature. Many believe that psilocybin affords the initiate or volunteer an opportunity to experience death and return from it.
So this work with psilocybin and these reorganizational kinds of emergent experiences that come out of that speaks very deeply to my own interest and longing in understanding the nature of consciousness. I mean, it seems to me that the fundamental question that we as humans are faced with is, what are we really doing here? How is it that we've come to be in this sea of consciousness and awareness? You know, what's really going on here? What happens when we die? How did this whole phenomena come about? These are the existential questions of life, and I personally can't think of anything more interesting and intriguing. And I think that psilocybin and work with these compounds provides a unique doorway into exploration of these sorts of experiences.
As science barrels into the future with new technologies to study ancient methodologies for healing and spiritual transformation, are we finally on the verge of understanding these psychedelic substances and their unique effects on human consciousness and neurochemistry? If psilocybin is the oldest classical psychedelic with widespread shamanic use, perhaps we are in the midst of a revival of the old Eleusinian-style mysteries. And perhaps these mysteries are finally being decoded and widespread. A large-scale medicine, heavily suppressed, demonized, and misunderstood, finally back into the hands of those who intend to heal the world's ills and voyage into the unknown. Another highly suppressed and controversial mind-expanding plant species that has been with humanity for ages is the North American peyote cactus and its sister in South America, known as Huachuma or San Pedro. Up next, join us as we investigate the history of psychedelic cacti use among indigenous across the New World and how they mirrored ancient Greek initiations as well as prophecies surrounding the unification of shamanic tribes everywhere.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation from Gaia on After School. If you want to watch more episodes of Psychedelica, please click the link in the description to watch the complete season for free. Thanks for watching.